Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Litzak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. And I'd like to continue on with the theories and fundamental ideas regarding the myths about money and exploring those myths. I've been doing this in a series of shows, which is continuing, really investigating into our money system, which is not what we have been led to believe it is. The creation of money has actually been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their money supply, inflating prices and robbing you of the value of your money. And we've been using as a textbook The Web of Debt by attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown. And I start with the credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Ellen Brown, who has written over 11 books and scores of articles on this topic. I highly recommend that you read her book, The Web of Debt, and can go to her website under the same name, www.webofdebt.com. For my shows, you can also get a review by going to www.kruufm.com. Look in the archives under Life and Debt. And for this particular series, under Life and Debt Web, to catch up on where we've been. To start off this week, I'd like to go back to the last point with which I finished last week's show, where we discussed a website called Money, What It Is, How It Works, by William Hummel. He states that banks today account for only about 20% of total credit market debt. The rest is advanced by non-bank financial institutions, including finance companies, pension funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, and securities dealers. Well, what does this mean? It means these institutions merely recycle pre-existing funds, either by borrowing at a low interest rate and lending at a higher rate, or by pooling the money of investors and lending it to borrowers. In other words, they do what most people think banks do. They borrow low and lend high, pocketing the spread as their profit. But that's not really the case for banks. What banks actually do is something quite different. And according to Hummel, banks are not intermediaries. Like non-banks, they also borrow, but they do not lend the deposits they acquire. And this is the critical point. They lend by crediting the borrower's account with a new deposit. The accounts of other depositors remain intact, and their deposits fully available for withdrawal. Thus, a bank loan increases the total of bank deposits, which means an increase in the money supply. What we're seeing here is essentially a sleight of hand. The money supply is being increased. It is a creation of the bank. The banks, by virtue of the way the system has evolved and the way the law has essentially either looked the other way or given its approval, allows banks to magically pull money out of an empty hat. So this is really the foundational point for how the bank is getting over, so to speak. They are lending money they are creating, not money that they have, based on what is called the fractional reserve system, which originated with the goldsmiths in England, lending out paper receipts based on gold reserves that they had in their safes, and knowing that only about 20% of the gold owners would ever come back for the gold at any particular time, they were able to lend out five times as much quote-unquote gold receipts, which people used as money, but which the goldsmiths did not own at all. Again, that's the fractional reserve system, and the whole U.S. banking system has evolved from that concept. And as we mentioned last week, it was in the 1960s actually challenged at the local level. The case was won, but it didn't have any precedential value over other areas or the country. And when it has come up in other cases, at least one judge said to the quote-unquote debtor who was challenging the fact that the bank did not have a contract because it didn't lend out anything it owned, which means no consideration for the contract. The judge said, if I let you do that, you and everyone else, it would bring the whole system down. I cannot let you go behind the bar of the bank. We are not going behind that curtain. Which here again is another reference to the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the allegory about this whole banking sleight of hand. Now, let's go to some other legal grounds on which bankers' fractional reserve loans could be challenged besides failure of consideration and what essentially is fraud. In theory, at least, these loan contracts could be challenged because they are collectively impossible to perform. Under state civil codes, a contract that is impossible to perform is void. The impossibility in this case arises because the banks create the principal, but not the interest needed to pay back their loans. The borrower has to get that money from somewhere else. The debtors scramble to find the interest, but there is never enough money to go around. Ellen Brown uses a very nice analogy. She says, in a grand game of musical chairs, when the music stops, somebody has to default. There was a treatise in 1850 called The Importance of Usury Laws. A writer named John Whipple did the math, and he wrote, what he calculated was this. If 5 English pennies had been lent at 5% compound interest from the beginning of the Christian era until the present time, which when this was done was 1850, it would amount in gold of standard fineness to 32,366,648,157 spheres of gold, each 8,000 miles in diameter, or as large as the earth. In short, 32 billion earth-sized spheres. Such is the nature of compound interest, which is interest calculated not only on the initial principal, but on the accumulated interest of prior payment periods. This is outrageous. The interest compounds in an exponential curve that is virtually flat at first, but goes nearly vertical after 100 years. Debtors don't usually grow to these extremes because most loans are for 30 years or less, when the curve remains relatively flat, but this is also a strong argument against getting loans that have been offered for 40 years or more for these mortgages. But the premise still applies. In a system in which money comes into existence only by borrowing at interest, the system as a whole is always short of funds, and somebody has to default. and I'll get back to this momentarily. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Let's look at an example. When a bank provides you with a $100,000 mortgage, what did we say? It creates only the principal, which you spend, and which then circulates in the economy. The bank expects you to pay back $200,000 over the next 20 years because of the interest, but it doesn't create the second $100,000, the interest. Instead, what the bank does is it sends you out into the tough world to battle against everybody else to bring back the second $100,000. The problem with this is that all money except coins now comes from banker-created loans. So the only way to get the interest owed on old loans is to take out new loans, continually inflating the money supply. Either that, or some borrowers have to default. What one scholar said was, and this is Bernard Leiter, greed and competition are not a result of immutable human temperament. Greed and fear of scarcity are in fact being continuously created and amplified as a direct result of the kind of money we are using. We can produce more than enough food to feed everybody, and there is definitely enough work for everybody in the world, but there is clearly not enough money to pay for it all. The scarcity is in our national currencies. In fact, the job of central banks is to create and maintain that currency scarcity. The direct consequence is that we have to fight with each other in order to survive. In other words, the system has been set up with the worst possible paradigm one can think of with respect to people, humanity at large, and quality of life issues. It all breaks down right from the beginning because the result, which is horrible, is necessarily a consequence of the fundamental premises set into operation. Let's take, for instance, a dollar lent at 6% interest compounded annually. Well, that dollar becomes $10 in less than 40 years. That means that if the money supply were 100% gold, and if banks lent 10% of it at 6% interest compounded annually, continually rolling principal and interest over into more loans, in 40 years, the bankers would own all the gold. But in some ways, more importantly, it also means that the inflation everyone complains about is actually necessary to keep the scheme going. To keep workers on the treadmill that powers their industrial empire, the financiers must create enough new debt money to cover the interest on their loans. They don't want to create too much, as that would dilute the value of their own share of the pie. But in a credit crisis, such as we are facing today, the central banks can and do flood the market with money created with accounting entries. For example, in a single day in August 2007, the U.S. Federal Reserve injected $38 billion into the financial markets to rescue troubled banks and investment firms. Basic question again, where did this money come from? It was just an advance of credit, something central banks claim the right to do as lenders of last resort. These advances can be rolled over or renewed indefinitely, and I'll talk more about this later. So we see that the system is actually set up to defeat the borrower, ab initio, right from the beginning. And it's actually the concept of how to rule the markets and manipulate all of the people who are subservient to the banks. And to keep the economic treadmill turning, not only must the money supply continually inflate, but the federal debt must continually expand. What's the reason for this? Well, it was actually revealed by Mariner Eccles, governor of the Federal Reserve Board, in hearings before the House Committee on Banking and Currency in 1941. He was asked how the Federal Reserve got the money to buy government bonds. The response was simple. We created it. Out of what? He was asked. Out of the right to issue credit money. The interview continued. And there is nothing behind it, is there, except our government's credit? His response was, that is what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money. Okay, now that explains why the federal debt never gets paid off, but just continues to grow. The federal debt hasn't been paid off since the presidency of Andrew Jackson, nearly two centuries ago. Rather, in all but five fiscal years since 1961, the government has exceeded its projected budget, adding to the national debt. The economist John Kenneth Galbraith wrote in 1975, quote, in numerous years following the Civil War, the federal government ran a heavy surplus, but it could not pay off its debt, retire its securities, because to do so meant there would be no bonds to back the national banknotes. To pay off the debt was to destroy the money supply. The federal debt has, in fact, been the basis of the U.S. money supply ever since the Civil War, when the National Banking Act authorized private banks to issue their own banknotes backed by government bonds deposited with the U.S. Treasury. And I'll get more into this in a later show. When President Clinton announced the largest budget surplus in history in 2000, and President Bush predicted a $5.6 trillion surplus by the end of the decade, many people got the impression that the federal debt had been paid off. But, like everything else, this was another illusion. Not only did the $5.6 trillion budget surplus never materialize, it was just an optimistic estimate projected over a 10-year period based on an anticipated surplus for the year 2001, which itself never materialized. But it entirely ignored the principal owing on the federal debt. Like the deluded consumer who makes the minimum monthly interest payment on his credit card bill and calls his credit limit cash on hand, politicians who speak of balancing the budget include in their calculations only the interest on the national debt. So by the year 2000, when President Clinton announced the largest ever budget surplus, the federal budget had actually topped $5 trillion. And by October 2005, when the largest ever projected surplus had turned into the largest ever budget deficit, the federal debt had mushroomed to $8 trillion. So Ellen Brown concludes, it is hardly an exaggeration to say that the money supply is the federal debt and cannot exist without it. Commercial loans alone cannot sustain the money supply because they zero out when they get paid back. In order to keep money in the system, some major player has to incur substantial debt that never gets paid back. And folks, this role is played by, yes, the federal government. In other words, the federal government is the major player that incurs substantial debt that never gets paid back. And I'll come back to this in a few seconds. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we've just seen one reason why the federal debt can't be paid off. In short, if it did, there would be no money supply. Today, however, there's even a more compelling reason. The debt has simply grown too large. To get some sense of the magnitude of an $8 plus trillion debt, If you took 7 trillion steps, you could walk to the planet Pluto, which is a mere 4 billion miles away. Or, just think of this. 1 million seconds is 118 days. 1 billion seconds is 32 years. 1 trillion seconds is 32,000 years. 8 times that, which is the $8 trillion we're talking about, is 256,000 years. Let's suppose the government were to pay $100 every second. In 317 years, it would have paid off only $1 trillion of debt. And that's just for the principal. If interest were added at the rate of only 1% compounded annually, the debt, in fact, could never be paid off in this way because the debt would grow faster than it was being repaid. Paying off $8+ trillion of debt in a lump sum through taxation, on the other hand, would require increasing the tax bill by more than $100,000 for every family of four during the year. In the 1980s, policymakers openly declared that deficits don't matter. The government could engage in deficit spending and simply allow the debt to grow. This policy continues to be cited with approval by policymakers today. The truth is that nobody even expects the debt to be paid off because it can't be paid off. At least, it can't while money is created as a debt to private banks. And that's the secret and the way the American population has been duped. For in fact, the government doesn't have to pay the principal so long as it keeps servicing the debt by paying the interest. But even the interest tab has grown exponentially and could soon be more than taxpayers can afford to pay. If the government can't pay the interest, it will have to renege on the debt and the economy will collapse, at least in theory, or perhaps myth that the too big to fail will ruin us all if they do fail. But let's look how we got into this witch's cauldron and how we can get out of it. The utopian vision of the early American colonists involved a money system that was quite different from what we have today. To understand this, that is, what we lost and how we lost it, let's start on a journey back down the yellow brick road to 18th century America. We're going to look at really experiments in utopia, at least economic utopia, how colonial paper money was used as legal tender. So from the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, quote, "Dorothy and her friends were at first dazzled by the brilliancy of the wonderful city. The streets were lined with beautiful houses, all built of green marble and studded everywhere with sparkling emeralds. They walked over a pavement of the same green marble, and where the blocks were joined together were rows of emeralds set closely and glittering in the brightness of the sun. Everyone seemed happy and contented and prosperous." End quote. About the Emerald City of Oz. Frank Baum, the writer, his vision of a magical city shimmering in the sun captured the utopian American dream. Walt Disney would later pick up the vision with his Castles in the Clouds, the happily ever after endings to romantic Hollywood fairy tales. Baum, who was Irish, may have been thinking of the Emerald Isle, the sacred land of Ireland. The Emerald City also suggested the millennial visions of the biblical New Jerusalem and the New Atlantis, the name Sir Francis Bacon gave to the New World. According to historians, the American colonies were an experiment in utopia. In an uncharted territory, you could design new systems and make new rules. Paper money was already in use in England, but it had fallen into the hands of private bankers who were using it for private profit at the expense of the people. In the American version of this new medium of exchange, paper money was issued and lent by provincial governments, and the proceeds were used for the benefit of the people. The colonists' new paper money financed a period of prosperity that was considered remarkable for isolated colonies lacking their own silver and gold. Edward Burke, speaking in the British House of Commons in 1774, said of the American colonies, quote, "Nothing in the history of mankind is like their progress. For my part, I never cast an eye on their commerce and their cultivated and commodious life, but they seem to me rather nations grown to perfection through a long series of fortunate events and a train of successful industry accumulating wealth in many centuries, than the colonies of yesterday, than a set of miserable outcasts a few years ago, not so much sent as thrown on the bleak and barren shore of the desolate wilderness, 3,000 miles from all civilized intercourse." The desolate wilderness, he was saying, of the colonies had been transformed into a fruitful abundance using a medium of exchange that economist David Hume called representative money and Benjamin Franklin called bills of credit, the paper currency of local colonial governments. Let's get into this idea. Money is credit. Historically, the distinction of being the first local government to issue its own paper money went to the province of Massachusetts. The year was 1691, 3 years before the charter of the Bank of England. Jason Goodwin, who tells the story in his 2003 book, Greenback, writes that Massachusetts buccaneer governor had led a daring assault on Quebec in an attempt to drive the French out of Canada, but the assault had failed. Militiamen and widows needed to be paid. The local merchants were approached, but had declined, saying they had other demands on their money. The idea of a paper currency had been suggested in 1650 in an anonymous British pamphlet titled The Key to Wealth, or A New Way for Improving of Trade, Lawful, Easy, Safe, and Effectual. The paper currency proposed by the pamphleteer, however, was modeled on the receipts issued by London goldsmiths and silversmiths for the precious metals left in their vaults for safekeeping, which we had discussed in the past, and really which was the birth of modern banking. The problem for the colonies was that they were short of gold and silver. They had to use foreign coins to conduct trade, and since they imported more than they exported, the coins were continually being drained off to England and other countries, leaving the colonists without enough money for their own internal needs. The Massachusetts Assembly therefore proposed a new kind of paper money, a bill of credit, representing the government's bond or IOU, is promised to pay tomorrow on a debt incurred today. The paper money of Massachusetts was backed only by the full faith and credit of the government. Other colonies then followed suit with their own issues of paper money. Some were considered government IOUs, redeemable later in hard currency, silver or gold. Other issues were legal tender in themselves. Now, what's legal tender? Legal tender is money that must legally be accepted in the payment of debts. It is as good as gold in trade. Without bearing debt or an obligation to redeem the notes in some other form of money later. Eventually, confidence in the new paper money waned, and Cotton Mather, who was then the most famous minister in New England, came to its defense, and he argued, quote, "Is a bond or a bill of exchange for £1,000 other than paper? And yet, it is not as valuable as so much gold or silver, supposing the security of payment is sufficient? Now, what is the security of your paper money less than the credit of the whole country?" Mather had redefined money. What it represented was not a sum of gold or silver. It was credit, the credit of the whole country. And I will continue in this discussion next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.